This is Indigo Radio, deepening understanding and making connections.
Indigo Radio, and I'm here with my host, Chris Levensey, out of Springfield, Vermont. And Indigo Radio is a project at the Spark Teacher Education Institute based out of Southern Vermont. We are a group of educators seeking to learn through engaging with others in our community and throughout the world. You can find us at indigo.radio on Instagram and Facebook, and you can download a previous show on SoundCloud and Apple iTunes. Indigo is now broadcasting out of Southern Vermont, Western Mass, Atlanta, Seattle, and Morocco. And I'm going to give it over to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Anna. Thank you very much. It's really nice to be here, and I'm really excited to continue this discussion. There was so many different threads that we had dangling from last discussion, so I'm really excited. Last week, we had Jonathan Elwell on to talk a bit about the purpose of prisons and the history of incarceration in Vermont. And you can listen to that, as Anna said, on part one on SoundCloud and Apple iTunes. And today we're going to go into part two, and we're joined again by Jonathan and also by Jaina Assoff, lead organizer for the Free Her campaign in Vermont. Jaina and Jonathan, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you all.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for having us.
So we'd like to start off today's show with Jaina. Jaina, if you could introduce yourself a little bit and tell us a bit about how you got into this work.
Yeah, so my name's Jaina Assoff. I use she, her pronouns. And as you all explained, I'm the lead organizer for Free Her Vermont. I really came into this work with a lot of my identities leading the way. I'm a Black Puerto Rican queer woman, and I'm directly impacted by these systems of incarceration. And I also have come from a long line of folks that have struggled with substance use addiction. So just having a firsthand view of what happens when we don't have community supports available and we don't have the systems in place to really help people not only survive, but thrive, and how people don't have the opportunity to become who they were supposed to be. So very young, I was very drawn towards social justice movements and really wanted to find the way that I could make the most effective change. And during college, I found the prison abolition movement, and that completely transformed me inside and out. That felt like the path, that felt like the way to get to the world that I had always been dreaming and yearning of. So since then, I've very much been grounded in the prison abolition movement and trying to abolish these systems of violence.
Just a quick follow-up question. Indigo Radio, we're all educators, ranging from K through 12 to college level and community college. I'm just curious around you when you were a college student and you got pulled into prison abolition. I was curious what influenced or shaped that, whether that be teachers or organizers or even readings that you did. I'm just curious the influences on you.
I honestly found it through community, not through school. I like being on like Black Twitter, like things like that, these radical spaces for people that look like me. And I found Our Prisons Obsolete by Angela Davis. And that was the first prison abolitionist piece I had really read. After that, definitely had a better understanding of what decarceration meant, how abolition wasn't about opening the doors and letting everyone out tomorrow. How it's about changing the foundation of our society to make it so the conditions that make prisons necessary are obsolete. Unfortunately, my education didn't really bring me to prison abolition, but it did help me see that there were a lot of untold stories, specifically around marginalized communities that I had no idea about.
It's really interesting too. I had this kind of the same question that Anna asked and wondered if there was a specific series of events. And I think about some of the things that brought me to this and to further kind of politicize me during my life. And very interesting to hear about that. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what's being proposed here in Vermont.
Yeah, so I when folks ask me this question, I like to zoom back at the beginning of this prison story. So back in 2019, direct service providers in the media really blew the whistle on what was happening inside Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, which is our state's one women's prison. And we learned about really terrible conditions inside the prison, like mold in the showers, maggots around, just a lot of awful things that humans should not be subjected to. We also learned about drug use by staff, sexual misconduct by staff, not only in the prison, but on parole and probation. And really, Vermont was in an uproar over what was happening inside the prisons. And our state legislature, as a response to this, they didn't study alternatives. They didn't figure out how they could change the culture or anything like that. They thought new prison construction was the answer. So they put out a bid for new prison construction, and that was awarded to HOK, a national architectural firm that's kind of renowned for progressive prison models. And they also subcontracted with local firms, Freeman French Freeman and McFarland Johnson. So they basically came up with this report that spelled out various options, I believe six or seven options for the state to go with. And our state legislature decided on option C, which is also known as the prison campus model. And so we are now dealing with the construction of two new prisons. And I will be very intentional about language here. We call them two new prisons, but the state calls it one women's prison and one reentry facility. And then after the completion of that project, that'll be somewhere between $70 to $100 million. They're moving on with the men's prison construction, which will once again be one men's prison and one men's reentry prison. And after everything's all said and done, estimates are looking at $500 million. Where we are today is DOC is deciding on a short list of sites for the potential prison, and we'll probably know in April or May. They've asked for authorization to purchase land when the session's done this summer so they can keep the process moving along. They've set aside 13 million for just planning and design. So we're about, let me do my math very correctly here, 17.5 million. We'll have set aside for this prison. We've already spent 4.5 million, but there's 13 set aside. But all this without even a shovel in the ground, it's pretty disturbing and it's upsetting that we couldn't think about how to spend even a fraction of that preliminary planning money on how to address some of these issues. immediately. But yes, so that's where we're at. We're waiting on a short site or a short list of sites, and the legislature has allocated a significant amount of money towards this project already.
I think maybe Jonathan mentioned this, but the estimated time that these would even be completed would be.
Honestly, I think what we just heard from a representative is that construction won't even start until 2026 or 2027. And that's just the beginning of construction. So, once again, I want to disclaimer this. This is speculation, but I think it'll be about 10 years before this thing is even built. And that reminds me, I don't want to go too far off a side tangent, but when we're talking about the people that will even be incarcerated in this new prison, CRCF only has six people currently that have sentences longer than 5 years. And of those six people, only three have life sentences. So when we're talking about one of their main arguments is that people are going to be languishing in this prison, like, first of all, we could build up supports to move people immediately into appropriate programming. And second of all, there's only going to be about six people even in there. So couldn't we build something new and different that's not a prison to start addressing these underlying issues? It just feels like a very manageable number to stop the use of prisons and really build up something else to foster accountability.
When you say that only six people are potentially will be there when this new prison is built, that they're anticipating then to fill this prison in the future. Would that be
Yeah.
fair to say?
Yes. So currently, to dig into these numbers a bit more, we have around 110 people currently in CRCF, but out of the 110, around 50 are only being detained. So we only have about 50 sentence folks, and half of those 50 sentence folks either have they're being held past their minimums. I believe 13 people from the last presentation I saw from DOC. Around 13 people are being held past their minimum, and around 15 are coming up on their year release mark. I feel that really points us in the direction of where funding should be spent. I believe, and I can double check these numbers for you, I don't think CRCF's population has gone over 130 since the beginning of the pandemic, and the new bed estimates are for 150 people. And they're trying to use the philosophy. I believe there's some statute through corrections where it's like the 85% filled rate, like 85% of your prisons need to be filled, something like that. So if you take that criteria and apply it to Vermont, we would need a prison that's only for like 100, 115 people. So even these estimates for folks that believe in reform or believe in prisons, this prison is just being proposed to be way too large. Not that we want it at all.
I was wondering if either of you, oh, Jonathan, go ahead. Did you have something to add? We lost you for a minute.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was just going to add that, yeah, the plan right now is for about 150 beds on the like long-term prison side of the complex, and then in the reentry side, they are like planning for about 30 beds. So it's about 180 total. And I think it's also just important to point out that kind of like the way the beds are broken up, because yeah, as Jane is talking about with the language, so often, the way folks are talking about it, you would think it's only, a reentry facility that they're building. And we'll get into this later, I'm sure, about like the promises around what that might look like and how it may or may not be different from other prisons and other incarcerative institutions. But regardless of what you think about that, over 80% of the beds in this new institution would be in the like long-term prison side, which you would probably not assume based on, how these conversations are being presented by folks in power.
Yeah, Jonathan, that is such a good point. And I just want to add something to that. This reentry facility is largely being modeled off Maine's prison model. And we've connected with people who are formerly incarcerated there. And there are a lot of issues with Maine's model. Like all these programs are just promises. Staffing issues usually get in the way of folks being able to actually attend certain programming or be able to be transported to their offsite jobs. for example, in Vermont, looking at our own situation, they're struggling currently to even get staff to transport people to the emergency room. So I'm not convinced that these programs will actually come to fruition. And if they do, they'll be inconsistent and not really providing the recovery and stability that they were promised. Yeah, and another part to that is currently only sentenced people would even be able to utilize the reentry facility. So that's like a big, what we talked about earlier, 50% of CRCF's population is only detainees. So if 50% of the population can't even have access to the reentry facility, it's just, we're seeing the holes already start to form, and I just don't think it's going to be as great of a facility as they're promising.
Gina, another clarification. Does that mean that 50% is either awaiting trial or, didn't post bail or some aspect like that?
Yes, exactly. So either being held pretrial, they're being held on a federal detainer, or what our state prison also does is they hold folks for ICE deportation. So we'll have folks that are just being deported as well.
I'm wondering if we could spend a little bit of time, and you've just started a little bit with some of these women are being detained by ICE, but if we could talk about who these women are. I'll just leave it open like that. If you could talk to us about who is incarcerated, who are these women?
So a big part of what we advocate for, like the National Council spearheaded the Free Her campaign, and these are women who were formerly incarcerated in federal prison together, and overwhelmingly, almost most of them are mothers. And that's something that we always like to highlight, is that children and families are the hidden victims of incarceration. So just pulling out some data, I was looking at some data before we came into this, and 1 in 17 children in Vermont have a parent that's currently incarcerated. And something I want to pull out from there is UVM did a study back in 2014 of our currently incarcerated population. And out of our whole system, the folks that were incarcerated during their youth, 40% had had a parent who was incarcerated. So we can really see this trauma to prison pipeline manifest, especially in families. So I just always like to uplift that, like we're incarcerating parents and mothers, and in a way, their children through this. Another thing I want to add is that overwhelmingly so, the reason why folks are ending up in CRCF is through drug transgressions or property transgressions that are associated with being able to, keep up with their survival needs or be able to supply their substance use. We have women who are struggling with mental illness, with substance use. And then another statistic I want to pull is that direct service providers say over 90% of the women in CRCF are survivors of domestic or sexual violence. So that's something that's especially just heartbreaking around women's incarceration, is so many women had really terrible experiences during youth. So I just like to share all that to humanize them. And yeah, we actually are having a rally in Washington, D.C. on April 24th, basically urging President Biden to use the power of clemency to release some of these women. And estimates say that on this Mother's Day, around 150,000 mothers will be incarcerated throughout our jails and prisons in the United States. So I'll end on that.
Okay, thanks for all of that. One of the things that I'm working on here in Georgia is around women who are pregnant and using substances. And the when you talked about mothers, I think that's great that you put that first, because children are losing their primary caretaker often. And one of the things that I have found in reading more about addiction and substance use is that there's this sort of false notion, or not enough research or myths around the woman is harming her unborn child by using substances. And so that is neglect. And we're going to get child protective services in, and we're going to then separate immediately. And that the mother then may be incarcerated because of a drug-related charge. The child is separated immediately after birth. And that is actually what causes more damage and pain to the child, not the substances being used. So I think that is something I've been thinking a lot about too. I think that like one of my frustrations around a lot of this work is that, especially around the criminalization of pregnancy and the criminalization of substance use, is that we have to be really clear that it's also about poor women and substance use and poor women and pregnancy. For instance, there's many middle-class white women that use substances while they're pregnant. Those women are not being swept up into the criminal justice system or into the child protective services. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the connection with class and race also around this.
Well, for one, like abolitionist theory teaches us that prisons are tools of oppression and control of Black and poor bodies. So I feel like all these things interconnect to almost reinforce the narrative that prisons are necessary. How you were saying, usually rich upper class women don't end up in prisons because just that's not the way the system currently works. I don't know if this gets exactly to your question, but just thinking of where the genesis of women's incarceration was very much tied into these ideas of like good women and like making sure folks were morally like present, you know, the old school ways of what we thought about femininity and being a woman. And prisons really started from a religious standpoint, and like nuns would almost try to correct the behavior of wayward women. That's the word I'm looking for. So I feel like we almost see the Genesis story of prisons continue with this criminalization of certain classes and certain color of people with their substance use and their pregnancy. And it's just continued as this tool to, I don't know, place. And this is not just women's prisons, but all prisons, I feel like, operate in a way of placing social failures on the individual. We have this idea of middle class women, like, oh, they've got it together. They don't need to be controlled. They don't need to be surveyed. That's not the necessity of the prison. I feel our ideas around who's put together, who's successful, really gets into our minds around who's can be surveillance in a prison. And not the best answer, but I just want to connect it to the root. Like, I think it's this idea of what a wayward woman is.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, this reminds me, Chris and I were talking last night, and just to touch on addiction again, and going off what you just said, we were talking about how many of us have addictions. And when you think about addiction very widely as something that is repeated, that does harm to you, that you relapse on and you keep doing, even though you know could be harmful to you. And that's behavioral addictions, that is substance use addictions, and that some of them are criminalized and some of them are not. And then also some of them are widely seen and some of them are not. So if, say, myself, or I'll just use Chris, if like one of us has some sort of addiction, many people would not ever see it because we have a home that we go to. We're not on the streets. We go to our, 9 to 5 job. And so I think that is important to bring in because I think there's a constant like divide between those of us that are seemingly getting our needs met and those that are not. And the ones that are not are definitely being criminalized and surveilled, like you said too.
Yes, thank you, Anna. You actually reminded me of Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Her analysis around prison abolition is more geographical and economic, and it's making me think about like the folks that quote unquote serve a utility for society, like pay their taxes, are able to provide labor, the list goes on. I feel the state isn't as consumed with what we have going on, but folks that they may view as needing assistance or like benefiting off government programs or stipends, things like that. I feel it's almost the prisons are used to hide them and make sure there is a utility because if they're in prison, they're doing prison labor, they're controlled in the walls and upholding the status quo. So I feel like this also connects back to what we think of as folks that are serving a purpose in our society.
Yeah, and I have a couple thoughts hearing what you're all sharing. So one is going kind of way back. The first women's prison in Vermont was in Rutland and started in like the 1920s, which, like we were talking about last time, that's like right at the height of the eugenics movement in Vermont. And, the incarceration of women, like we've been talking about, is also like deeply interlinked with like the incarceration of young people and family policing. I've got this quote that's actually from the UVM website where they have a few different pages on the history of eugenics in Vermont. And they write that in 1915, juvenile delinquency was legally defined to include such offenses as school truancy, associating with, quote, disreputable persons, using vulgar language, and, quote, wandering around the streets at night, which just speaks so directly to what you're talking about, Anna, about who that kind of like, the breadth of that, of who is seen as disreputable, what's vulgar language, what is wandering, like all of these things, it's just wide discretion, for certain people in certain places to be policed. And there's like very clear continuity of the same kinds of people and the same kinds of places being policed, in the century since then in Vermont. And I think what's really kind of damning about this new proposal is that I don't think anyone imagines that the communities and the people who are incarcerated will actually change in any way. It's just about, how can we provide more services to people who we are, inevitably going to incarcerate, who we know are disproportionately, living with substance use disorder, experiencing homelessness, having experienced violence in different forms. And I think there's something really damning about that acknowledgement that we know we don't support people, in effective enough ways. So they will inevitably be policed and they will inevitably end up incarcerated. So let's just try to do incarceration a little bit better. And just one last thought is that also in Vermont, as across the country, the incarceration of women really started to grow exponentially in like the late 90s, which correlates really directly with welfare reform and with the real like gutting of welfare under Clinton in the mid 90s. And that's when you see the incarceration of women start to rise. And in Vermont, then when CRCF ends up getting repurposed to be solely a women's prison. And so again, who is being incarcerated and how could we support them, in other ways to actually get to the root of what's happening and what they're experiencing.
And Jonathan just reminded me when you were talking about this really terrible view of we're almost accepting that these folks will always be swept into incarceration. We can see that thought process play out across the country. I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but along with Vermont, 39 other states are proposing prison or jail construction. And something my executive director has noticed is this disturbing conflation of corrections with social services. So, like, we will see all the supports that should be community-based housed right in the middle of prisons. And it's just really upsetting that we think people need to receive records for support.
But when you're young and yearn to be a woman, your mother know? I couldn't understand her hang-ups and her fears. A year went by and I got tired of Mama's foolish advice. At 14, I was sure I knew it all. It wasn't like
drawn by a couple things. One, and I talk about this with my students in class, and a couple kind of entry points with them looking at the arbitrary nature of laws, right? And the goals of prison over time and how that's changed. And I think, Jonathan, you just mentioned this arbitrary nature. And I was thinking about the, quote, good or acceptable addictions and the ones that aren't acceptable and the ones that get swept up into this. And I read a study recently about, I don't know if it was 20 or 40%. It was a shockingly high number of, I think it was 14 or 16 year olds had placed a wager on this kind of gambling things that you can do on sports and other stuff. And they're always given, like, if you have a gambling problem, contact this phone number, as if that will deter someone. We were also talking last night about things like, is it Kratom and other things that are sold openly at gas stations in various parts of the country. And even in my school, the students that are would, in a blind survey, identify as having porn addictions already, right? And those kinds of profitable things for certain people are acceptable in a number of ways, and others are swept up in this. And that's something that I think is really important to tease out a little bit. The second thing what we recently, a couple of my students have been looking at is the domestic violence and talking about the nature of prisons, prison guards identifying stress and lack of control, et cetera, and the huge kind of a greater than, I would say, the population of domestic violence that they would self-report about their peers and themselves, and what that means for a community like mine in Springfield, Vermont. Or I was thinking about the ancillary, or maybe not ancillary, the impacts of this on communities as well. And if either of you wanted to talk a little bit about that, the very nature of prisons, what that brings to communities.
So something specifically, prisons, we're always told that they bring these promises of jobs, et cetera. Usually they are huge environmental hazards. So on one hand, they're destroying communities. And the culture of corrections, I know the statistic for police officers is pretty high around the amount of them that are domestic abusers. But I feel like the same can be said about correctional workers. And not only that, I don't know if Jonathan got into this last conversation, but substantially high numbers of staff report PTSD, depression, anxiety because of the work. So it's not only disrupting the material fabric of a community, but it's also destroying individual community members, and that ripples into families, and families are the helm of communities. So then that ripples into the rest of communities. So definitely just trying to keep that highlighted, like you were sharing, because a lot of people think that the economic benefits that come along with prisons outweighs what they do to communities. But I just wanted to share that.
Thank you for that. And I remember from the teach-in that Jonathan did, there was a rough quote about that it's clear by any measure, even the prison officials themselves over time, that prisons and caging people and the violence that is involved has not and does not work. And like to spend maybe the rest of the show or a good portion of it talking about the organizing around stopping this prison specifically and prison abolition in general. And so if either of you wanted to start us on that path a little bit, and we could go from there.
So yeah, Free Her, we are a campaign spearheaded by the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. One of their tools to really operationalize this huge idea of ending incarceration for women, girls, trans, and non-binary folks. And we essentially function as a microcosm of that organization. So a lot of our work is through advocacy. So we'll testify at the State House, we'll meet with different committees and caucuses, and just try to facilitate conversations with other government officials. We also have worked on legislation with Representative Brian Chena that pushes us in the direction of something new. Like what we introduced last session was a prison moratorium, which would put like a 5-year pause on the construction, design, acquisition of new prisons. And then with that, we wanted to present a solution. So we had the Alternatives to Incarceration Working Group that would put together a group of directly impacted people, government officials, and other necessary stakeholders to look at what it would be like to transition us to a system that was grounded in restorative justice. So that's the advocacy piece. And then we do something called Reimagining Communities, which is our people-powered programming that, one, reminds folks of the power they have, and two, is basically like a larger mutual aid project to make sure our communities have what they need and really start disrupting the conditions that make it so prisons are necessary. And that's through our canteen fund, where we collect donations from the community to put on people's commissary. We have a basic income guarantee program. At this time, we're able to give $500 a month to a formerly incarcerated woman for a year. And we have our participatory defense hub, which is a community organizing model of folks being able to support people through their legal process. So we'll do things like get in touch with their public defender, attend court with them, help file motions, create social bio packets, just amazing stuff. And we have our People Not Prisons, which is a base of volunteers that really helps us grow the campaign and create new ways to help our community. And Jonathan's one of the leaders in PMP. And then the last bit of our work is shifting the narrative. And I think that's like the most important piece of our work. So we'll do things like this. We'll jump on an interview. We'll hold canvases, phone banks, panels, anything to really bring these conversations directly to the community. And we actually just worked on a zine together. So we have that to be able to educate folks on just like the history of incarceration and what we have going on now, how to get through some of those tough questions. But yes, that's a bit about Free Her's work right now.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more around this phrase, alternatives to incarceration, and what people that you're working with come up with and say around that.
I'm glad you asked this. I think a lot of people think for there to be an alternative, we have to almost have a duplicate system. Like we need something to replace the prison. And something that's so important is, no, we're not trying to replicate this system or institution at all. So what this new iteration of fostering accountability will look like will be incredibly different. And to me, that means the first step in this is bolstering up what already exists. Like to me, our community justice centers are an alternative. Transitional housing is an alternative. Our crisis respites like Alyssum or Soteria House, those are all alternatives. Whatever we can do to address those underlying issues that doesn't involve a punishment paradigm and the deprivation of one's dignity, to me, is an alternative. So I listed a few, but A really great example is the Incentives for Success program that just recently launched through Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform, and Sarah George is also helping with this. It's only funded through a $75,000 grant, and they're estimating that they'll be able to graduate 40 people from this program. So what they did, Sarah George called around to the chief of police in Williston, Colchester, Burlington, and Winooski, and asked for a list of folks that were cycling in and out of prison. So she figured out who would be a best fit for this program, and it's more based on contingency management. So like positive reinforcements, and folks will get money or other types of rewards for remaining sober, showing up to meetings, getting things done. And that's had really good success. And what we've urged the legislature is to start studying some of these places and programs to just see what kind of outcomes we get compared to our prison system. So that first step is just bolstering what we have and also filling in the missing gaps. I'm not sure if I mentioned this earlier, but we get a lot of letters from women in CRCF that they're being held due to lack of residence. And the longest time I've heard is 1 year. So like right away, we don't even need that fancy of an investment in alternatives. We just need an apartment building so we can be moving folks out of prison. Another thing we're hearing is that folks, a condition of their release is going to rehab and all the rehab beds are filled. So once again, another alternative, just making sure there's enough beds available and these supports that should have been there before prison. Another thing is we used to have these wider spectrum of housing options for currently and formerly incarcerated women. I don't know if folks have heard of Northern Lights or Mandala House, but these were transitional homes that really had the skills and infrastructure to be able to help out with more specialized needs. And those were taken from us. So like all these things that were making it so we could actually transition away from prison just keep getting plucked the more we continue with the system. So for that alternative piece, I'd be like, okay, look at the holes, let's fill them, and then let's build up what's already working. And then for a future, something that Representative Brian Cheena and I have talked about along with other advocates is, how about we purchase one of those empty state colleges, do a housing first model, so everyone's living in the dorms, and on that first level, we just have varying levels of supports and services and really wrap people around in support. So like they could go to that first floor, connect with their case manager, find someone that can help them get to their appointment. They find their therapist there, like everything available in one place. That's one of the dream alternatives. But I will share that like less work needs to be done than people think to build up something different.
Yeah, a couple things that come up hearing you share that, Jaina. Like you're saying, the alternatives are already here. There are some new things we need to do for sure. But basically everything either exists and is underfunded or exists and is criminalized, right? Different ways of surviving and supporting each other. Yeah, it's really a matter of actually uplifting those things, not in like, yeah, and I want to build on what you're saying about the community justice centers and about transitional housing, because the CJCs in Vermont and restorative justice programs are usually kind of, you know, held up as like a shining light of corrections. And, you know, then DOC like last spring came out with their, you know, new mission statement and values that are all about restorative practices. And so it's used to kind of like launder the violence that is happening in the prison system. Because even though the CJCs, you know, were created for the most part in like the 1990s, 30 years ago, they still get like single digits in terms of the percentage of the DOC budget. I don't have the figures right in front of me, but I believe that, you know, the actual like restorative justice budget is like 2% of the DOC budget. And then for transitional housing, it's like 5 or 6%. I could be wrong. I can find the actual budget and we can link that, but it's in that ballpark. And so that's the kind of thing where, you know, is this just like pretty rhetoric to put a nice face on an inhumane system? Or are we actually going to meaningfully invest in those things so that those things actually do characterize the system, right? Instead of being, you know, the exception.
I just like have this quote clear in my head of Maryam Kaba, who talks about transformational justice, is that she says that feminists should not be partnering with the state. And I think that it's tricky when you have the Department of Corrections involved in funding restorative justice. You're both nodding your head, so I know you all think about this too. And I know in some states it is, and in some states it's not, but I do know the history of restorative justice and transformative justice definitely like did not have the Department of Corrections in mind.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, Anna. And I think it's really interesting to look at like the origin of restorative practices under the DOC's control in Vermont, because that came about in the 1990s when there was this like crisis over overcrowding in Vermont's prisons. And, you know, they did this market research about what different programs people might like. And the public, you know, in these surveys showed a huge like lack of trust in prisons, you know, and the ability of prisons to like keep people safe, but also an interest in restorative practices. And so then DOC turned to restorative practices and started to market it as this like big, new, really different thing at the exact same time as they were building Newport and as they were building Springfield, which are the two largest prisons in the state. So you've got these really striking quotes where the folks who were in charge of DOC at the time, who were overseeing the construction of these new prisons, are also talking about how the fact that as long as the community, you know, divests itself from being interested and engaged in like restorative processes, you know, they'll always be disappointed with the results. They'll never actually feel safe. I think that's really striking. Yeah, again, just about when restorative practices came about and, you know, were they really designed to change the system or were they just kind of designed to like release some pressure on the system at the exact same time as it was expanding in a really drastic, harmful way?
Jonathan, I wonder, I have a lot of thoughts around this too in terms of the school. And we recently have brought in this paid position of a restorative practices person. And I was connecting this back to the zine. And one of the questions that always is brought up is, what do we do with the murderers and the rapists? And you talk about in your zine about no one's ever introduced to violence the first time by committing it, is one of the quotes from there. And Jaina, as you were describing, there's a whole number of pieces that go into the various root causes of what people are struggling with. And like, for example, in our school, if we place a restorative practices person on top of this existing system without doing any of the other things, and in fact, what's happened with us, an increasing number of cameras in the hallway. I had my students walk through and count them to get to the front door to the second floor. There's 27 cameras they have to walk by. Tonight, they just approved having vape detectors in the bathrooms. And so there's a number of things that are going to draw in all kinds of students into this system at this early age, freshmen onwards. And we're putting this little piece on top, which in and of itself might be a fantastic piece with 100 other pieces that deal with the root causes, but by itself, it does nothing. And in fact, I think in many ways adds to the situation. And so as we've mentioned before, like this nonprofit industrial complex, someone who's supposedly gone through this training to go teach it and practice it in our schools is getting paid a teacher salary to do this. It's really, I don't know what the right word other than angering and frustrating and seem totally ineffective. But I liked, as you were describing, the long-term and the multifaceted way to go about this and not plopping one piece on there and hailing that as the medicine for this, something that's rotten. I wondered if you could talk about how students could, or anybody could get tied into this, could get connected to this, whether it's accessing the zine, how can I have my students or anybody in our community get connected to this? Are there things that you could suggest and talk about in that sense in terms of us organizing ourselves or being in partnership with what you're doing or others?
I'll jump in first here. So with abolition, one of the beauties of it is this movement can utilize any type of skill. So whatever your passion is, whatever feels meaningful to you, like connect with your abolitionist folks and we'll find a way to plug you in. But specifically around students, I would urge students, what we've seen is folks creating their own student-led organizations, and they could do like some kind of a restorative community group or restorative student group, or they could take it even further. It could be like Students for Abolition, something like that, and really start tackling some of these issues head on in their communities. I think abolition is the most effective when it's super hyper local and grassroots. So just by students like digging into that camera issue or the vape detectors and sharing their thoughts on how having these cameras and a restorative justice coordinator, it's just they cancel each other out. So I would say empowering folks to take leadership in their community spaces as best as they can. Get your people together, whoever's like-minded, and start figuring out what issues in your community connect to this carceral infrastructure and building from there. If that feels too daunting, you can find Free Her. And we have our People Not Prisons meeting that is biweekly on Thursdays right now. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours. So I would suggest plugging in there. That's a great place where we brainstorm next actions, just check in with each other, get updates around what's going on in everyone's community. And also, I would encourage them to talk to other folks in their community. Like something we've seen is a lot of Vermonters don't even know about the prison construction. So just telling folks that this is happening, hearing their thoughts, what they think could be done better. A lot of organic organizing happens just from a simple conversation. So those are some things I would throw out to folks that want to get involved.
Dana, I'm just wondering for our listeners too, could you, and both of you could weigh in on this, when you say abolition, what do you mean by that?
When I say abolition, I mean the complete abolishment of prisons. And since folks may be listening who don't agree with all infrastructure being called prisons, I would say any facility that's under the control of the Department of Corrections that deprives people of their humanity and takes away their freedoms and liberties is considered a prison. So when I talk about abolition, I'm talking about dismantling those types of facilities and system and building up something that is rooted in restorative justice that really gets to people's urgent needs to help them have a stable foundation to then engage in the process of accountability and recovery. So I hope that's clear for folks, but yeah, a complete dismantling of the system.
Yeah, and I think what I would add, along those lines and thinking about also what we talked about last time with kind of different iterations of incarceration in Vermont history and kind of the larger history of violence that that's linked to is that prisons and policing are tools of capitalism, of imperialism, of white supremacy. And so to me, abolitionist struggle is anti-imperialist struggle, right? It's anti-capitalist struggle. And it's a struggle like to fight for all of the things that those systems, have taken away from us and try to tell us aren't possible. And, going back to your question about like for young people, communities, if you want to be involved in the struggle against what's proposed for a new prison in Vermont, that's amazing. We'd love to have you. But that's not just like, the horizon of abolitionist struggle. Any opportunity to come together with people in your community, and organize against, life-taking systems and organizing for, life-making systems, life-making possibilities. That's abolition lived out in the most beautiful ways.
Great. Thank you both for that.
One of the questions we had at the end was that would there be, and I think maybe you've covered this, but I was thinking if there are, you're in front of my class, were there particular takeaways that you'd like to leave them with? And then the second piece, and maybe connected to this, is there anything else you want to add or share or with us?
Yeah, I guess what I would reiterate at this point is just that, reform is how we got here. And a lot of the proposals, for how this new prison could be different are really like seductive in many ways. And it would be beautiful if they were true, and so much easier than the huge untangling and undoing and remaking that abolition asks of us. But that is really what's needed. If you're still feeling the pull of reform at this point, there's this program called the Prison Research and Innovation Network. That was a 5-year grant that the Vermont DOC was a part of, running from 2019 to 2024. And I won't go into too much detail now, but essentially, it created the survey data that we've referenced a few times for both incarcerated people and folks who work at Springfield, and then also created a really unique opportunity for folks who are incarcerated there to be a part of organizing inside the prison and kind of co-creating changes based on what those surveys revealed. And then over the course of, a couple years, as they were trying to create these different programs together, it became clear to the guys involved that they were essentially just being lied to and misled. And then once they spoke out against this to other folks within the DOC, they were retaliated against. They were moved to other prisons where they couldn't participate in the program. And then folks who are still at SSCF in Springfield are facing increasing, surveillance and coercion as part of it. And I can link an article that was co-written with some of the incarcerated folks who are involved in this in the show notes.
My closing thought would be to remind people that the folks that are incarcerated aren't these dangerous criminals that we've been taught through fear-mongering and propaganda. They're just everyday people like you and me that are struggling, that don't have the same access to resources or sa social safety nets. So the only thing left to catch them is prison. So I want to remind folks that no one wants to be engaged in criminalized behavior. People are struggling and hurting. And if we could, as a society, change how we approach folks that are harmed and being harmed, and if we could just have a little bit more care, that would take us a very long way.
Great. Thank you so much. And Jaina, we'll also link to this, but can you tell us where people can find you and Free Her?
Yes. So we are on Instagram at FreeHerBT. And then you can find us online at the National Council, just www.nationalcouncil.us/Vermont.
Okay, great. And we'll definitely link to both of those.
Yeah, I was just going to say definitely send us an email, send us a DM on Instagram. Yeah, if you're a teacher, student who would want us to come to your classroom, let us know. We'd love to do that, or other community events.
We know lots of teachers, so.
Yeah, that's like 2/3 of the folks who listen to this.
Thank you so much, Jaina
Yes,
and
thank you.
Jonathan.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for the work that you're doing in Vermont. And we'll definitely follow this and we'll make sure to put all of this, all the notes and where to find you on our show.
Thanks. Same to you both.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, that does it for this episode of Indigo Radio. A big thanks to Jaina and Jonathan for joining us today. A reminder that this is part two, and you can listen to part one on SoundCloud or Apple iTunes or whatever podcast app you subscribe to, you'll find us. Part one was all about the history of Vermont prisons. We will include in the show notes how to get in touch with Free Her Vermont. A reminder that you can find us on Instagram at indigo.radio, and be sure to subscribe and like our shows. We're going to go out today with the Jailhouse Blues.
Well, I wouldn't mind staying in jail, but I gotta stay there so long. Well, I wouldn't mind staying in jail, but I have to stay there so long. You know, it seemed like all my friends, well, they done shook hands and gone. Thirty days in jail with my back turned to the wall. 30 days in jail with my back turned to the wall. I'm just sitting there thinking about another Skinner. Old man is kicking in my jailer. Will you please, sir, bring me the key? Middle jailer, will you please, sir, bring me the key? I just want you to open the door, 'cause this ain't no place for me.